This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Tuition for the Vermont State College System ranks as the second highest in the country for in-state students in public four-year colleges. And the legislative appropriation for the college system is one of the lowest in the country. That often leads to the head of the state college system begging for more money at each new legislative session. So it should come as no surprise that how to adequately fund public colleges and keep them affordable for in-state students is back on the agenda at the State House. The House Appropriations Committee has included in their budget a one-time $800,000 increase for the state colleges only, so it doesn't apply to UVM or the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, or VSAC. Usually those are all funded together. That bill has passed the House, and it's currently sitting in the Senate Appropriations Committee. Today on the show, we're going to look at how to fix the system, and then we'll look at the national landscape for higher ed funding. And we're joined first by Jeb Spalding, Chancellor of the Vermont State Colleges. Welcome back to the program.
It's nice to be here, Jane. Thanks for the opportunity.
Let's think of this as a little bit of remedial education first. In very simple terms, is the reason that in-state tuition is so expensive due to the fact that the state legislature appropriates relatively little to the system? So instead of the state sort of subsidizing higher ed and state taxpayers at a high rate, it's up to students to pay it. And then I know financial aid comes into the picture too, but very basically, is that the equation?
There is an equation. It's a direct correlation between low state support and high tuition. The only state that has higher in-state tuition than Vermont is New Hampshire. And when it comes to state support for public higher education, we're in the basement of a league of our own. But there's one other connection I'd like to make, and that is between high tuition and low college enrollment. Vermont has one of the highest, most favorable high school graduation rates in the country. And, you know, relative to other states, our students do pretty well, too. And we graduate a lot of them. One year later, our college enrollment is the lowest in New England. And so that high cost, although there are many other factors that are related to whether people continue on to college, cost is like at the top of the list. That's a problem for opportunity for Vermonters and our competitive stance for the state.
And, you know, again, this may seem derivative, but and it's important that students go to college. Why?
Well, because, you know, I mean, I think people – thank you for asking that question, because I'm pretty passionate about that. And, you know, people ought to know that the Vermont State Colleges are the de facto public school system when it comes to the post-secondary years. More Vermonters go to one of the state colleges than all of the other colleges and universities combined in the state. And we're, you know, lucky to have a lot of star students. But we also have a lot of students that struggled in life, struggled in school, and if it wasn't for one of the state colleges, they probably wouldn't be going to college at all. But college is increasingly the linchpin for upward mobility. We know that we have, you know, a big gap between upper and lower income quartiles. The surest way to address that is with a college education. But it's more than economics. And, you know, people can read every once in a while that, gee, the difference between over your lifetime a bachelor's degree or a high school diploma is about $1 million. So it's a pretty good return on investment. But it's much bigger than that. If your children don't get a college education, the odds that your grandchildren will have a run-in with the law are significantly higher. The odds of your children or grandchildren having good health outcomes are significantly lower. So there's, you know, a lot of stuff on the economic front, but there's a tremendous amount on the social end, too, where a college really is the difference between the haves and the have-nots. And, you know, Vermont, by having a low college continuation rate, is essentially prolonging the kind of social stratization that we see out there, and we don't want to have. So,
which seems strange given the politics of this state. Why do you think it is that Vermont's legislature is consistently, at least in this modern era, one of the states that provides the lowest proportion of
their ed? it's been going on for decades. Back in the 1980s, about half of the funds that came to this half of our revenues for the state colleges and the universities, well, came from the state. We're now down to, at the state colleges, like 16%. Overall, and within the state college system, for some of the larger ones, we just split that up, the amount we get from the state. Some of them is down to 9% of their revenues come from the state. So it's happened over many decades. And I think really what happens in Vermont is, and it is a, it's a question of, you know, choices. And, you know, we have chosen to have a very secure safety net. And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, that's where we've made our priorities. And, you know, what I find with, you know, and with a hat I wear on now at the state colleges is that we have a hard time competing with the crisis of the year. So, you know, this year, for example, I mean, we know we needed some more child protection workers, that we have an opiate problem, that Medicaid was more expensive than we thought. And those sort of crisis, every year there's a few of those. And it sort of got easy for the policymakers, including myself, since I used to be one, to say, well, you can limp along another year. I guess nothing bad happened. So what's happening, though, is that, you know, actually we're actually putting the future of our Vermonters at risk by not helping them go on to college. And I do have to say, just with my publicity hat on, Jane, just so if there are people listening that are either thinking of going to college or have kids that are thinking of going to college, very few people actually pay the announced tuition. And there are a lot of ways you can lower the cost of going to college, from everything from doing dual enrollment or early college when you're in high school to maybe starting with a couple of years at community college and then transferring to one of our other state colleges, the university. There's a lot of scholarship money out there these days. So, you know, people.
So you don't want people to be scared off?
No, I don't.
We're talking with Jeb Spalding. He is the chancellor of the Vermont State College System. And I'll point out that that's Linden State, Johnson State, Castleton University, Vermont Technical College, and the Community College of Vermont.
Very good.
And I passed the test. And maybe there are some families out there who are in the position that Chancellor Spalding was just mentioning. If you've been thinking and looking at Vermont's landscape for higher education and the cost, and if you're a taxpayer here and you think about it from another perspective, we'd love to hear what you think, or if you have a question for the chancellor. And in a few minutes, we'll be talking with a reporter from the Chronicle of Higher Education about how other states doing it, sort of putting Vermont into a national context. So again, if you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. There is this $800,000 special one-year-only appropriation that's being considered in the legislature this year. What would that money actually do for you?
Well, I first want to say we hope it's not a one-year deal.
Aha, you hope it's ongoing.
Yeah, and we had asked actually the legislature to consider linking an annual increase in our appropriation to the same inflator that's used for the general fund support for K-12 education. So there is an index in statute that every year the general fund goes up. That money goes into the education fund, right, used to support public education in the K-12 system.
So this would be an $800,000 increase, and then from then on you'd like it to be indexed to that inflationary rate?
Yeah. The answer is yes, but we haven't succeeded in getting them to adopt a linkage. What we have done is that $800,000 will be a base increase, so it'll be in there again next year, the $800,000, but what we need is increases on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. So I think what that $800,000 does is take some pressure off of tuition. It allows us to make sure that we are maintaining quality at our colleges. And it's a real shot in the arm as far as our morale too, Jane. I mean, we are, with the governor's recommend, and before the $800,000, we'd be at the same level of state support as we were in 2008. If this 3% was one time, it would be a nice thing, but you know, we're hoping we need modest increases on an annual basis. You know, we have the at least 2/3 of our costs are personnel related. We have been doing what we can to really tighten our belts. Our actual payroll is down a couple of million dollars because we have 170 fewer people working for the Vermont State Colleges right now. Not something we necessarily like, but we are, you know, trying to do what we can to make sure that we're operating as efficiently as possible, and you know, really trying to have the legislature understand that. And I think we've made some progress. I mean, that $800,000 increase for the Vermont State Colleges, I think, is a recognition of how important public higher education is, as we already discussed earlier, and that it's time to start reinvesting. So, you know, whereas the legislature didn't want to make a commitment by having automatic increases every year, our hope is that this is the beginning of an ongoing process of modest increases to take pressure off of tuition.
So is that exactly what it would go for? I mean, you just mentioned that the payroll is down partly because there's been staff attrition and in some cases staff layoffs. But, you know, I assume as well that if you're cutting costs, that quality suffers and that you have trouble retaining and hiring highly qualified staff and faculty. So at what point do you start to see the quality equation being a problem as well?
Right. Well, we're doing our very best to make sure that where we save money allows us to focus the money we do have on quality educational experiences for students. So, you know, when we can find ways to reduce our financial operations, that's the back office, the engine room kind of stuff. That's where we're trying to save money. And we're doing that at the system level. We have also created some strategic alliances with Johnson and Linden and CCV, Community College of Vermont, and Vermont Tech, and looking for ways that they can collaborate. And actually, our hope is increase student opportunity. You know, we think if we can have faculty members working together across campuses using technology, that students at one campus would have not only access to the professors that they are on campus, but the professors at other campuses within the college system.
Let's go to Jonathan, or John rather, who's calling in from Richmond. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello, Jane. Hello,
Hi.
Mr. Spaulding.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I should say.
Hi. I look at education at all levels, but, you know, in this case, higher education, as an investment. You've alluded to that. I think many people see it as a expense. I was wondering if you can quantify, and it sounds like you started to do that, quantify the cost, if you will, of not investing as we have over the past 30 years, say. Because I look at it the same way. It's an infrastructure cost. It's the same way with our roads and bridges. If we're only fixing it when it's about to fall into a river, it's had years of decline. Can you quantify the cost of not investing regularly?
Thank you for your question. Somebody probably could put the actual dollars and cents to it. I don't have those figures. What I can say is that, you know, it ranges from everything from limited economic opportunities to higher societal costs. You know, Vermont's one of a dozen states that spends more on corrections than they do on higher education. So the lack of investment certainly has a tremendous cost across the board.
We got some notes from listeners as well. Emerald says almost 50% of Vermont-born students go out of state for college because it's cheaper. Many of those students never come back, bringing their skill and tax revenue to other states. Aaron says, I'm a Community College of Vermont student, and I must tell you that the experience has been wonderful. The classes are very affordable. I'm a person with disabilities, so I live on a very modest income. And the people work really hard to see you succeed. I value our public system, and I hope to someday give back to it. And a Vermont State College employee who wishes to remain anonymous says, I think that for quite some time, the state has failed its public college system. The colleges pay near the lower end of the higher ed spectrum in terms of employee compensation, which makes it difficult to attract and retain talent, as well as making it difficult for some employees to provide for their families. These problems have been compounded at some locations by poor decision-making by the administrations. And I think that in some ways our state has tried to do higher education on the cheap, and our schools have suffered. So Chancellor Jeb Spaulding, you know, looking at this sort of piecemeal approach and nickel and diming that's been going on at the legislature, if you had the ability now to just scrap it and come up with a new system that works both for funding and for quality higher education for students, what would you do differently?
Well, I think we'd have to set some different priorities at the state level and have a more adequate level of financial support for public higher education. But I really have to say, you know, there's some linkages there in the little emails you related that I think need a little explanation. It's true, roughly half of the students that are going on to college from high school in Vermont go out of state. We'd like to do something about that. You know, sometimes it's cheaper for them to go out of state, but many times it's more expensive, and I don't think they're getting even as good an education as we can give them at our Vermont State Colleges. So I'd really appreciate it if people would take a first look at one of our in-state colleges, either the state college system or the other independents, but in my case, one of our Vermont State Colleges. I think we you know, obviously have not the luxury of paying what we'd like. but I am continually impressed by the faculty we have at our Vermont State colleges. You know, the email from the person at Community College, we have wonderful people there. But, you know, at Johnson State or Linden State or Vermont Tech or Castleton, we have some great faculty members. And a lot of those faculty members, you know, actually come from whatever, Ivy League schools. And they're at one of our state colleges because they like to teach. They're you know, they didn't want to go someplace where they have to publish or perish. They wanted to teach, and we have smaller classes, and they get to know their students by their first name. And I think we, you know, given the limited funds we do have, offer a very high quality education. And, you know, we're trying to do things that actually raise our visibility so people actually can get the most affordable option right here at home and have it be high quality as well.
But to the idea of do things need to change, Peter in Middlebury says, you know, as we're struggling with all of this and dealing with the decline in Vermont student population, should we think about closing one of the campuses? I mean, would that help solve an issue?
Closing one of the campuses is not on our radar screen. Everything else is. You know, at some of our state colleges, about half of the students are commuters, and they're doing that because they're living at home and keeping their jobs. If we close one of our campuses, it would probably, you know, be in the northern part of the state where access would be limited to Vermonters going on to post-secondary education. So, you know, what we're looking to do is, find ways to actually streamline the cost and reduce the redundancies in the administrative functions without closing a campus. And that's what those strategic alliances are about between Johnson and Linden and Vermont Tech and CCV. And those are meant to supplement the system-wide, across the entire system, efficiency. So, for example, we have a common IT platform. We do a lot of the HR work. We do student billing. You know, we do all the legal services, one collective bargaining agreement for all the colleges. So we're trying to actually look for ways to make sure that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the limited dollars support things that students actually care about.
Jeb Spalding is the chancellor of the Vermont State Colleges. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was short, but sweet.
That's right. And coming up, we're going to put Vermont's issues in context and look at how other states are addressing these burgeoning costs of higher education. Let us know what questions you have about how it's done elsewhere and what you think Vermont could apply from other states' approaches. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're looking at why higher ed costs so much and why Vermont students pay the second highest rate in the nation for public four-year college tuition. We just heard from State College's Chancellor Jeb Spalding, and now we're going to zoom out and look at the bigger picture for higher ed funding in the U.S. and see if any states have the perfect formula. You can post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. And we're joined now by Eric Kelderman. He's a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where he writes about state higher ed policy. Eric, thank you so much for being with us today.
Great. I'm glad to be here with you. Thanks.
How poorly is Vermont managing higher ed funding?
Well, I don't know if I want to categorize it as poorly or well, but certainly you're on the lower end of the spectrum. In terms of per student state appropriations for higher education, the chancellor was on mentioned the low rate of state appropriations, and you are well below average in terms of your per student amount of state appropriations.
Yeah, and he said sometimes 9-16% of the total revenue for each of the colleges.
Yeah, you have to be careful with those statistics. I mean, when you look at, for instance, a large flagship university, you know, when you say that the total budget, if that includes, for instance, a medical facility or something like that, then, you know, those revenues sort of distort that picture a little bit. But in general, I would say, you know, the amount of money that comes from states to the colleges that actually support the students in their general fund is somewhere between a third and half at most places. And so you have to parse the numbers just a little bit. Now, they're probably a little closer to reality when he's talking about the regional four-year campuses.
Hmm. Yeah, and we should say the state college system, it does not include UVM, but of course,
right,
UVM is included in the larger picture of public higher education in Vermont. And Eric, you know, as you focus on states and public higher education, we're including UVM in this part of the discussion.
Right.
Is any state doing it really well, managing that equation of not too much tuition for in-state students and for out-of-state students, but not too high of a tuition, but also, you know, managing how much it's going to cost state taxpayers?
Well, that's a tricky balance, in part because, you know, when states appropriate money for higher education, there's no fixed amount. These funds come out of discretionary budget dollars from the state, and they're competing, honestly, the higher ed dollars are competing with money for K-12 education and for areas of the budget that have risen very quickly over the past two decades, including Medicaid. In many states, state pension costs have skyrocketed. That's put a strain on the state budget. Prison costs in many states have risen in recent decades. And so higher ed has to compete with all those other areas of the budget for their share of the pie. And so that has put a constraint on the amount that that legislators are sometimes willing to put into higher education.
So when you look at, though, any particular states that stand out, I mean, that's great because that shows us the whole landscape and that, mm-hmm. you know, across the country, it seems like higher education is struggling against other needs that states have. And
right.
Chancellor Spaulding mentioned that. But do you see any states that you think from your reporting, wow, okay, well, this one has struck a balance that, you know, other states might want to emulate?
You know, there are different approaches being taken by several states in terms of trying to strike that balance. In general, the states that are funding higher education at the highest levels are states that have had a lot of discretionary money to spend on higher education. In I would say over the past decade, generally that's been states with a lot of oil and gas revenue. You look at a place like Alaska and Wyoming. But that's changing, of course, with gas prices plummeting. Some of the bargains, though, that states have made with their institutions of higher ed in recent years have been for them to, the state legislature, to maybe make a small increase or a modest increase in appropriations for higher education and asking the institutions to freeze tuition. That's become a common approach. California has done that recently. In New York, for instance, the State University of New York system negotiated a few years ago for what they called a rational tuition increase, which meant that they would increase tuition at a set rate for each of 5 years so that families could budget. The other problem with, you know, categorizing it as right or wrong is, you know, the cost to educate a student at all of these institutions varies so dramatically, right? And the way we fund higher education is we give a lot of money to flagship universities that have a lot of infrastructure and where they pay their faculty a lot. But those universities tend to get the best students. We give a lot less money to the two-year and public four-year regional campuses where they get students who might be struggling a little more and maybe need actually a little more support. So the equation in many cases is backwards from some folks' point of view.
You know, when you look at countries that provide a much higher subsidy for higher education, we've seen in recent years, even in several of those countries, tuition rates rising. We've seen, in the United Kingdom, for example, students really getting upset about tuition rises. In Canada, in Brazil, there have been riots and rallies. So do you think that there's a fundamental shift happening? I mean, is there any way the U.S. could ever go to, for example, a Bernie Sanders plan and really, at a much higher rate, fund public higher education?
Well, that's going to require some political will from voters to get to that place. There are states that are pushing for, as you probably know, something called, you know, free community college. Tennessee was one of the first to really propose this. And in a way, it's, you know, it's an interesting thing because really what Tennessee has done is it's more of a college a recruitment plan than it is a financial aid plan because the state is paying what's called the last dollar of the cost. So when a student applies, they either get, say, a federal Pell Grant if they're very low income, or they might get a state grant first, the Tennessee state scholarship. And then the state supplements whatever cost is left, that financial aid to cover whatever tuition and fees are left after all of those. So that's the so-called free part. And really, they're not spending a lot from the state's point of view. They're spending on average about $1,000 per student. There's some you know, unusual situation in there in Tennessee that makes it possible. They're using state lottery funds. Not every state has a lottery. And if they do have a lottery, they might have allocated all of that money for other purposes.
Hmm. But you don't see us moving with the political will that's available to a system where, you know, it's basically or almost free higher education for everyone in the country.
I don't know about nationally if we can do that in the short term. I think certainly a lot more states are looking at that. Oregon has jumped on board with this proposal. There are, I would say, maybe a dozen or more states that are considering similar items for two-year colleges. Nobody's talking about making four-year, in quotes, free. The other thing about the free college thing is that in these cases they're covering tuition and fees, but they're not covering you know, other expenses that you might accrue, the sort of opportunity cost, your living expenses, for instance, while you're going to school full time.
Mm. Yeah, although there are several countries where they defer the costs of, you know, loans that you've gotten even to pay for living expenses until you're making enough of a living later on to pay for them. But now we're getting into tax policy, and I promise we won't do that. So, you know, given all that we've been talking about and all of the challenges that states are facing in trying to budget for everything that's going on, including, you know, prison costs, including in Vermont, as Chancellor Spalding mentioned, paying for child and social services, paying for the opiate crisis. Do you think the quality of public education in this country is suffering?
Wow. You know, that would depend a lot on the institution. You know, when you look at – when people talk about quality, they often refer to things like graduation rates or retention rates. Those are not always the best measures to determine, you know, the institutional quality. I think when you look broadly at higher education, what you see is institutions, elite, prestigious institutions that attract really good students, have great retention and graduation rates. Two-year colleges that are attracting the local populace, where kids might not have the greatest academic preparation for college because of a variety of factors, because of the K-12 system, or you know, their own home situation, or whatever. Those places have much lower graduation rates, and so it's hard to determine quality. We are moving to a place where the federal government and accreditors are demanding more evidence of student learning, and I guess that leads to, in theory at least, more evidence of better quality in higher education. But that's a long road, and it depends on how you define quality.
Eric Kelderman is a senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where he writes about state higher ed policy. Thank you so much for being on the program.
It was my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll talk wood turtles. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Steve Perrin is a biologist with the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. For the past 30 years, he's been studying wood turtles, including a population of about 40 individuals that lives in a stream passing through his property. Perrin says these turtles are sometimes picked up by illegal pet traders, so I can't say where exactly this spot is. But Perrin suggested that I just describe it as a low-gradient stream in the foothills of the Green Mountains. So there you go. That's where I met him last week to talk turtles and to see if we could spot one.
So this is really, really amazing. On Christmas Eve last year, so the 24th, I found a wood turtle right here on the bank. Wood turtles should not be on the bank in late December. I found two that day.
But that was when it was like 60s here.
Yeah, it was like 67. Yeah. It was like 67. But that was probably 2 months later than I had ever found one before. I don't really look in December. but then I found my first wood turtles this year on the 12th of March. That's the earliest by a few days.
For them, does it matter? I mean, obviously, you know, there's some questions about climate and how it's changing, and their habitat could change. But in terms of being out, as long as it's a warm day and they want to sun themselves out, is there a problem for them to be doing stuff in December?
No, I worry, like, they change their physiology when they hibernate. So they're pulling oxygen out of the water column and absorbing it, but they're not air breathing. And so I was wondering this year, so now if we have a really locked down with cold, will they be able to just flip over to underwater respiration again? Or, you know, I'm assuming that evolution took care of that for them. But I think that if you got fooled and came out and left the stream corridor and then you had a cold snap, you'd be frozen up in the woods.
Which is not going to be good
for
the
turtle. You know, I've been monitoring these turtles for a long time. They stay real close for a while, then they wander a little farther. But, you know, they don't go out of the stream corridor until late May.
So they follow the old farmer's almanac about last frost, and then you can leave the stream corridor?
Well, let's hope the last frost is predictable like that. That's the real danger with climate change, is not so much the temperature for these guys, it's the variability. And then, like we saw with Irene, it's the flashy floods that we have, and those can impact wood turtles. You know, I know of a study down in Massachusetts where they had a flood and it blasted the wood turtles out of the stream. They washed downstream over dams. And then some of them had radios on them. They tracked them trying to come back. And, of course, they're in unfamiliar territory. They're beat up, and survivorship suffers. You know, they suffer. But it's already got so much else going against it. You know, most of our roads are built along rivers and streams that wood turtles live in, so that we've had the vehicle roadkill issue for a long time. Turtles been around, like, looking pretty much the same since the Jurassic, and it worked really, really well until you have pavement and cars.
Yeah.
Now, you know, pulling into your shell isn't going to save you. And then because of other changes to the landscape, we got rid of some of the bigger predators, and we have an agricultural landscape, at least here in the Champlain Valley, and we've got raccoons and skunks beyond anything we would have had in the past. And they're predators of turtles and turtle eggs. And so a lot of my turtles in this population are missing pieces. A leg here, a tail there. Yeah. Mammalian predators take their toll. And then, you know, it's not just the raccoons and skunks, which in my opinion are overly abundant, but it's things like otters. You know, if they just had the normal stuff, you know, it'd still be a tough go. But now they got the subsidized predators who do well because of us, the roads, and then if you add climate change and, you know, more unpredictable stream flows, you know, it's not a good scenario.
And you said you have us just, well, you know, as people who seem to like to take turtles.
Well, some people do, and it's usually just thoughtless, you know, it's a turtle, let's bring it home, and, you know, and if the parents don't say, hey, let's not do this, or they pick up a turtle, I'll bring it home and show the kids, and then they let it go, well, it's, you know, it's two towns away, and it's sort of like kidnapping one of us and letting us go in India, you know, we're not home, we don't know where we are, that doesn't help your survivorship, and then just the development of the landscape itself, you know, where you lose the habitat, it gets built into infrastructure for us.
And wood turtles are also part of the pet trade? They have beautiful shells.
They're part of the illegal pet trade. They're not legal. And we have had issues in Vermont with illegal trading of wood turtles. I've ended up with a backyard of wood turtles in a pen as a result of one law enforcement action. North American wood turtles have found their way to the Hong Kong marketplace, which is illegal. They're not legal.
Perrin and I walked along the stream bank, tromping over old goldenrod and other vegetation that died and got flattened out by winter weather. Perrin told me that's exactly where we should be looking, under the latticework of straw-colored sticks and stems.
And then they're going to look a lot like a rock. They're pretty clever. They actually are smart enough that they'll detect that I'm coming and they'll hide. They'll go to the base of a cluster of ferns or something.
So you don't have some relationship with them where they know, like, oh yeah, that's our buddy.
Like, oh no, here we go again. What's he going to do today?
In case we don't see a wood turtle, how would you describe one?
One of the names for the wood turtle is red leg. They have kind of orangey red, skin on the legs and on the throat. So if that's showing, it's very dramatic. If they're pulled in, you see a brown rock.
How big do they typically get?
In this population, a male, which is bigger than a female, will get to maybe 8 inches, maybe 8 1/4. In different populations, they can get up to 9. And eventually, if they've been out there for a long time, the bottom of the shell is polished yellow. And the top vertebral scutes, which are the top layer of scutes at the dome, they can be polished off. And there might be kind of a brown with yellow highlights pattern. They can be quite pretty.
Well, even the ones that aren't sort of polished off, their shells are pretty remarkable
they
looking.
Are. The scientific name is Gryptemys insculpta. And insculpta is because of the pattern on the shell. There's like a sculpted shell.
And it's like different for people who haven't seen them. To me, it looks like, you know, a similar shape repeated. And then, as you said, a very low pyramid because it's their old shell on the top. So you have all of these little pyramids all over the shell right. of the turtle.
So if you think of like tree rings. Yeah. Imagine that, but kind of a little raised relief. And you could feel it. If you ran your fingernail down, your fingernail would catch on the different growth layers.
Yeah, they're really pretty, even though, as you said, they're not shiny. They do look
no,
like a rock.
They're not shiny.
Good. All right, I hope we can see one. Yeah, we didn't see one. We walked up and down the bank, and then we split up and covered either side of the river. But those 40 or so turtles on this mile-long stretch were hiding not only from Steve Perrin, but from me, too. So after Perrin forded the stream to cross back over to me, and while he dumped the river water from his barn boots and wrung out his socks, we talked about conservation of this apparently elusive species. We've talked about the wood turtles and some of the reasons that they might be threatened by human behavior and by predation and by landscape changes. And there's actually a move afoot, not for the first time, to get them listed as an endangered species.
Right, endangered or threatened. So there's a federal petitioning process, and that's happened. And then there's a series of reviews. The first is whether or not the petition is warranted a second look. That's where we are right now. They contact all the states and anybody who knows anything. I sent in comments, a copy of a paper. And
so you think they should be listed?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really care about this species, but because I care about it doesn't mean it meets the standard for listing. And, you know, we want every listing to have really good justification because we don't want people start going after the Endangered Species Act, which is arguably the most important piece of conservation legislation we have in this country. So
you'd like more study?
Well, I want the review to go forward. There's starting to be a lot of work done on wood turtles. I happen to have been looking at wood turtles in this population since 1984, so I have a nice long timeline. And my population is kind of beat up, you know, from roads and, you know, residential development and agricultural use of the landscape. But still they're persisting, and they live 60 years, so they can persist a long time. You know, it's part of our natural heritage. It's a unique species. It's been here for thousands of years, and it deserves to stay here. And as humans, I think we can afford to share the state of Vermont, or the country for that matter, with the wildlife that belong here.
That was Steve Perrin, a biologist with Vermont Fish and Wildlife and a longtime wood turtle observer and researcher. Perrin sent me a picture of a turtle he spotted just a few days later on the same stretch of river, it figures. You'll find it on our Facebook page and at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And that does it for today's show. Now, each spring, Norwich University hosts a conference of prominent thinkers on the military, intelligence, and international affairs. Tomorrow, we'll be joined by two featured speakers, Carl Marlantes, who's written extensively about his experience in the Vietnam War, and retired Army Colonel John Coffin, who also served in Vietnam and has worked intensely with Vermont veterans returning from war. That's tomorrow on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.